2-2 pitch. A swing and a long drive. Deep left. Way back. Gone.
Hello. Welcome back to another Baseball America Fantasy Podcast. This is your host, Jeff Ponce. Alongside me, as always, is my co-host, the master of the Robo Scout. He's getting the robot kicking again. It's coming back in 2026. It's Dylan White. What's going on, man? How are you?
I'm doing well. Building some data centers to house all the Robo Scout CPUs or whatever Robo Scout uses. I don't know. Quantum physics. I'm doing well. It's a blizzard here in Toronto. Well, not a blizzard, but there's like 12 inches of snow came out of nowhere overnight. A bit nuts over here, but I'm just cozy in my office here, podcasting about baseball.
Yeah, there you go, up there in Canada, enjoying the snow. Yeah, you showed me that picture, and I was like, it's actually been unseasonably warm here the last couple of days. It's been like 40, 50 degrees, which is downright balmy with the type of December and early January we had here in Massachusetts. So, but you know what? People aren't here to hear us talk about the weather. We're talking about first year player drafts today on the show and our rankings that recently came out on the site last week. This is kind of my baby, Dylan. I love doing the first year player draft rankings, mostly because I follow college baseball. I follow the drafts. Involved in some of the conversations. I know who many of these players are for years before they're eligible in these drafts. It's just a fun process to kind of sort through them. And, you know, we do one ranking after the draft, kind of update a little bit. And then after the handbook season's over and I've, you know, proofread a million chapters and read the thing from front to back and all that, kind of sit down and I start to go through my rankings. I'm going to kind of put Dylan in the host seat a little bit today. But Dylan, before we jump into the FYPD rankings, this might be old hat by the time this thing publishes tomorrow morning, but what about these Stevie Cohen, Kyle Tucker ambiguous tweets? Kind of fun. Seems like he's hinting at the signing could be coming. He's talking like he's in the papal conclave.
Yeah, I took, he said something about, is there smoke? Do you see smoke? I took that as, oh, okay, great. Kyle Tucker has chosen the Mets, and it's just a matter of like announcing that it's official. And then he followed up by saying, oh, you know, I'm referring to like the decision hasn't been made. And so then I was thinking he's kind of like the ball's in Tucker's court. So like, let's see if His Highness makes the decision. So that gave me a bit more optimism as a Jays fan. At first, I was like, ugh, all right, I guess the Jays are out. And then now, oh, maybe they're still in. But yeah, I mean, it would be great to sign the Kyle Tucker. There's rumors it's the Jays, Mets, Dodgers. Jays offered a long-term deal. Mets offered a lot more money per season, but maybe not as long. Maybe opt-outs or maybe shorter, etc.
Yeah.
So who knows how this soap opera is going to end. And there's still Bo Bichette too. Like, I don't know if the Jays will pivot to like Bo Bichette or if Bo Bichette's waiting for the Tucker signing. I mean, I'm hearing Red Sox like are all over Bo Bichette. I don't know. So it's the two kind of major chips, not counting Cody Bellinger, kind of remaining. I mean, I guess there's Framber as well.
There's a few. Giolito. There's some interesting players that I think are going to impact fantasy seasons. I just made a trade. I needed a third baseman badly in my 30 team league. And I don't love it, but I did trade Adley Rutschman. And then I traded Kodai Senga and I got back Matt Chapman and Lucas Giolito, which I think all things considered is kind of an even trade, but I like the security of Giolito a little bit better, which I don't know. I'm like knocking on large pieces of wood as I say that, but it feels like there's a chance that Senga's not in the rotation or something is really broken. He's also, I think, a couple of years older than Giolito. Mm-hmm. And then Chapman, like, you know, fine. It's probably the same production, just slightly better than I would get from Adley Rutschman. But I'll just have to find a catcher, which is honestly a lot easier than finding a decent third baseman these days. Like, that was That's not an easy task, because you're either shopping at the top of the market or a lot of players that you're like, this is kind of replacement level. So ended up with Matt Chapman for a couple of years. We'll see how that goes.
Very good. We made a trade in the Devil's Rejects. I say we, but it's really Brian. And I watch and cheer on from the sidelines. It was basically Peyton Tolley for Luis Peña. I mean, those are the key guys. A lot of people have Tolley higher. A lot of people have Peña higher. Peña is kind of sweet. We got Peña, traded Tolley. Peña, struggled a bit when he got his high A, I guess. So he kind of felt like he was like top 10, top five, and then he kind of slid down, and now, maybe he's not as good as we thought. Oh, the defense isn't as good. Oh, kind of the warts are showing. And so, we thought maybe that's a buy low opportunity.
Yeah. I think what happened with him is people got so caught up in, there was like this level of like almost like trying to prove that the Jesus Mate hype was like Jason Dominguez 2.0 or something like that, and not necessarily rooted in like actual game performance and data. And I think there were a lot of people in like the, I think Peña is better than Mate camp, and I think that really drove the bus kind of early on Peña. And he's a really good player. He's a really good hitter. It's just, he's probably not like a no doubt shortstop and like super twitchy, but he's got great instincts, great bat to ball ability. The angles are pretty good. There's some impact there. I think the approach needs to mature a little bit. And that was kind of always lurking under the hood. So I think he's more adjusted into a place where like it's appropriate now in a lot of rankings. I would still have him higher in like a fantasy list than I would have him on our real life top 100, which we finished working on this week. So that will be out soon. I still think he's a great fantasy prospect and would be happy to roster him on any of my teams, Dylan. So that's me saying I'm not knocking Luis Peña at all. I think just sometimes, especially when you're talking like a guy goes from like unranked to like on the list to like top 15 to 20, like sometimes a guy can drop 20 spots and like kind of settle into a nice spot in the rankings, but people are almost like disappointed because there was that like overreaction period that then kind of had to adjust. Right. It's just like anything, it's like waves. It's got to settle in. It's always going to have like a dip and a peak and then, kind of settle in the middle. So, all right, Dylan, did you want to mention anything on the Ranger Suarez signing with the Red Sox? What do you think about that location and landing spot? I get it. He's been a great performer. Obviously drives a ton of ground balls, gets enough strikeouts. There's enough command, has pitched well in big moments. And the Red Sox obviously are looking for as much pitching depth as they can possibly have under contract and available to them in their 40-man roster. But at the same time, this is a guy that sits like 90 miles an hour. And, it's a deal that he's going to be, into his 30s by the time it's done. So how do you think this deal is going to look? And is it a good landing spot? How do you feel about that from a fantasy perspective?
So we had sent out the Tolley offer for Peña, and then the Suarez thing happened. I'm like, oh no, he's going to back off and reject withdraw the offer or whatever, because that, part of Tolley's appeal is he may be in the rotation. He's more of a long-term thing. It's not, getting Tolley for 2026, but so that was interesting when that happened. The team is good, so like you're gonna get wins, but like he's a lefty in Fenway, so the Green Monster, he can face a lot of righty batters. Not great. He has a pretty high ground ball rate. He's like in the top 25%, I think, if I remember right. So that's good. But yeah, he's a bit older. So I was surprised. Like, I thought he went for kind of more than he was going to get. And then especially for the Red Sox, I just, like you said, like they have so many options now in the rotation for the next few years that it's weird to spend, that kind of money on someone who's, I think he's 30 now, right? So he'll be like 35 when it ends. So, you know, pitchers age a lot slower. Their aging curves are not as like defined as for hitters where, you know, 27 and it becomes come down. Like pitchers kind of stay up there at 29, 32, even for a while. So, you know, it's maybe not that bad, but yeah, I don't think it's great for him, but I don't think it's bad. I think it's kind of neutral. Like the wins will balance off sort of the ratios, I think. I think maybe it was more of an overpay on the Red Sox side. He's a great pitcher. He's going to do well, and he's going to help their team, obviously. But, you know, there's a lot of money invested for sort of a short track record and a lefty in Fenway.
Yeah. You know what? Let's move on to the next signing. Not signing with the Red Sox. Alex Bregman going to the Cubs. What are your thoughts on Bregman for 2026 and then just the next – 3-year window as we usually talk, so 26 through 28, and then his impact, the impact of his signing on Matt Shaw's potential value and then Nico Horner's value if he's not traded, or, you know, if he potentially is. So if you're like a Matt Shaw or a Nico Horner owner, I guess is what I'm asking, put yourself in their shoes and kind of how would you handle those situations?
I'd feel a lot better with Nico Horner than Matt Shaw. Nico Horner plays gold glove defense. He's like a 4-WAR player. So even if he gets traded and the Cubs want to put Shaw at second, and so Horner's traded, like he's gonna hit, and he's probably gonna hit at the top of the lineup. He's a, you know, 280 hitter. So like he's gonna be the top of the lineup. He steals bases, he plays defense, so he's gonna get full-time at bats. If I'm a Matt Shaw owner, I'm a bit worried. Either they're going to trade him or he's going to sit on the bench, or maybe they believe in him more than Horner and they move him to second base. I don't know. I think, you know, lots come out about his political leanings, and I know there's a lot of people who don't like him. That probably has, you know, landed in the front office. And so like, do they want someone who's, I don't know, divisive? I don't know if you say that or not. I don't know. So I, you know, I'm a little less comfortable with the signing. In terms of Bregman, you know, he's famously got, you know, low bat speed, but it's like the air pull. So at Fenway with the Green Monster and the Crawford Bucks with the Astros, he's really kind of done well because of that. So he got more home runs than he hit more home runs than, you know, his bat speed and exit velocities and all that would otherwise indicate. And I saw, I think it might have been Mike Petriolo from MLB writing about Isaac Paredes, same kind of thing, who's, again, famously an air pull guy, only pulls his home runs. And when he came to the Cubs, he did not hit home runs. So I could see Bregman not hitting 20 home runs. I could see him being 15 home runs. I could see him being 12 to 15 home runs, especially, you know, in a few years. So, I mean, he'll still be a, you know, a high WAR player. He plays good defense, former shortstop, great bat to ball skills, etc. Good lineup around him. So he's going to still be a very valuable fantasy contributor. It's just maybe it's not the best landing spot for him specifically if you're a dynasty owner.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, 100% true, especially like a right-handed pull hitter too. I think it plays bigger to left field than anywhere else. And I'll just say on like the Shaw stuff, man, you know, it's the Ricketts. I don't think they care. I think if you're going to have problems enough with the Cubs, there were plenty of problems that you could probably have with the Cubs, frankly. But let's take a quick break here, Dylan. When we come back, we're going to get into FYPD. What do you say?
Let's do it.
All right. We'll be right back.
Every day, companies you've probably never heard of are making billions off your personal data. Your name, address, phone number, even details about your family are pulled from public records in the internet and then sold without your consent. There's an entire marketplace making money off of your privacy, and most people have no idea it exists. Aura's online security capabilities have allowed me to feel safe when it comes to my online presence. Aura fights back. They remove your personal data from broker sites and keep it off. Aura also alerts you fast if your information shows up in a breach or on the dark web. But Aura is more than just a data broker removal. It is a full digital security suite that protects every part of your life online. Aura gives you a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager to keep logins safe, and spam call protection to cut off scammers. Aura also scans the dark web for your most sensitive information, like your social security number, bank logins, and passwords, and notifies you instantly if they're exposed. Aura also removes what is already exposed, protects what's not, and puts you back in control. Right now, you can try Aura free for 14 days when you visit aura.com/remove. That's enough time for Aura to start removing your personal information from data broker sites. Sign up today at aura.com/remove and get the peace of mind that your privacy, identity, and finances are safeguarded. That's aura.com/remove. Certain terms apply. See the site for details.
All right, we are back, and I am going to put Dylan into the hot seat. I'm going to have him ask me some questions, and I'll sit on the other side and play smart guy analyst for once. What do you say, Dylan?
Let's do it.
All right, well, I'm going to hand it over to you, and I'll throw up the first question.
Why do you have Tatsuya Imai at number one? Famously signing with the Astros, a pitcher who, you know, didn't want to sign with the Dodgers, maybe because he wants to be better than Ohtani and Yamamoto, not be in their shadow, or in Sasaki. So why do you have Tatsuya Imai at number one?
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of safety at this point. Like, I think you could look at either of the, you know, NPB bats in Murakami and Okamoto, and, you know, see more upside because it is a hitter. I think you could look at some of the college arms and see more long-term upside. I think the same with that prep shortstop group that we'll talk through in a few minutes. But ultimately, you're going to get immediate impact in year one from Imai. I think he could be really good, and I think he could translate in a way that maybe differs from some of the other NPB imports that we've seen, you know, Yamamoto, Ohtani, like freak examples, you know, even Tanaka when he first came over. But I think just like where he can locate the fastball here, the types and styles of hitters that he's going to face, the fact that I think he has a really interesting slider, and it's his best pitch. It's been his most effective pitch in NPB. I think there's maybe some question marks how in terms of how it translates. It's kind of a reverse slider, not dissimilar from Treya Savage's, but different in the sense of like it moves a little differently than your Savage's does. But more often than not, breaks a little bit arm side. Doesn't really have anything that goes glove side at all. Has like a sweepy kind of curveball that he'll throw, but he doesn't throw it all the time. But I wouldn't be shocked if, you know, maybe there's something that they could add in terms of like a fourth pitch. It is the Astros. They tend to like their pitchers to have 4 to 5 pitches in their arsenal. I've heard some discuss that there's two different variations of like off speed, like a changeup and then a splitter. Primarily based on the numbers that I've seen, it looks like it's just a splitter. I've watched it. You know, like most splitters, it can look a little different from time to time. Like they're a little bit wild in terms of that tail at the end and how much it might run. If you told me there's two different variations of it, sure. That's kind of interesting. So he does have 3 pitches that I think he can miss bats with. He didn't miss as many bats in NPB with a fastball as you'd expect. Some of that I think has to do with flatter swing contact hitters. And that tends to push guys like this who are, you know, low release, high spin efficiency, you know, flat VAA, you know, decent extension, like all that stuff. It tends to like force those guys to have to throw down a little bit more, you know. And I think when you watch some of the Japanese games, you see a lot more like low strike zone fastball locations that you don't necessarily see in the big leagues, right? You just don't. Unless guys are throwing sinkers from like a steeper plane or whatever. I think he can ride that thing like at the top of the zone, get more chases than maybe he got in NPB. You know, he might give up some home runs too, especially like with the Crawford boxes as a righty. Like I think that's going to happen. So the ERA may not be pristine, but I think it could be like high 3s, like a low 4, but I think the Ks are going to be higher. than what I've seen in the projections. And the other big part of it, Dylan, is like I said, you're going to get 3 years of production before most of these guys are up. I think there's higher upside guys. Now, that said, if you're a rebuilding team, I might look at my situation in my league and I might approach it a little bit differently. But I think that pick, like, you know, if I'm just looking at it blindly for most teams, you're probably going to take a mile. If you're in a shallower league, like a 12-team league, it's a lot easier to turn your team from maybe the worst team in the league or one of the worst teams in the league to a competitive team that, you know, could potentially win the championship or whatever. In a 12-team league, you can do that pretty quickly. That's a majority of leagues that, you know, people still play in. For Dynasty, maybe they're a little bit deeper, but still, you know, I think we're going to see a my go one in a lot of these drafts. So I don't think it's that controversial of a pick, but I do think there's a few different ways that you can kind of go at one, depending on what your league's like and how it's set up.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. The Astros love their, you know, flat BAA, high IVB guys like Luis Garcia, Christian Javier, that type of thing. And so Imai fits perfectly there. Those guys, you know, they kind of outperformed their projections coming up in the minors. So, you know, I think I could see Imai definitely outperforming his projections. And like you're saying, in a deeper league, like 30 team league, you want Imai, I think, because he's going to play in the majors and be like, even if he's Casey Mize, I'm just trying to pick some like random kind of average pitcher. Like that's still solid. And that's still useful and productive in a 30 team league. And in a 12 team league, like, it's so shallow, you can churn your prospects. Like you want a Cade Anderson or Seth Hernandez and wait. Like we've seen like Andrew Painter and Ricky Tiedemann, it's years before they even like sniff the major league. So I see Imai being like a solid pick no matter the type of league you're in.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a chance that like Anderson's up late in 26 or even like early 27. But there's also a chance that like he's not up until 2028, you know, like it is an organization that has a pretty stacked pitching staff. Now get traded, some other things could happen, but there's no guarantee there either. But I do think in certain leagues, in certain circumstances, he's definitely somebody I might consider at one, Dylan. So
perfect segue. So who else would you consider other than Cade Anderson at number one overall?
Yeah, well, I think Doyle and Anderson, especially in leagues where maybe the MPB players aren't available, I still think offer quite a bit of upside and potentially some immediacy in terms of they could be up in the big leagues within the next couple of years. I'm higher on Doyle than others are, and I'll kind of dig into that a little bit now. I watch a fair amount of college baseball. I don't see a lot of guys that dominate in their draft year in the fashion that Doyle did. I don't see a lot of lefties with the power that Doyle has. Now, there's questions about his fastball usage and maybe a lack of a plus secondary. I think the splitter flashes plus. I think that can be a really good pitch for him, especially as a lefty. He's got a few different breaking ball variations. I think there's enough feel for spin in there to potentially get to an average or better breaking ball. And it's an all-world fastball. I mean, even in the organizations where they value breaking ball usage to an extreme, like the Red Sox, you'll get a guy like Peyton Tolley who throws his fastball a lot, right? And we just saw Peyton Tolley, who wasn't as good as Liam Doyle in college, who probably didn't have as developed secondaries as Liam Doyle in college, essentially do what Liam Doyle did by adding the velocity, having this flat plane left-hander, and then kind of cascading a bucket of different, you know, secondary shapes off of that. The off-speed maybe being his best, but doesn't always command it. It's not that different. Like, it's kind of the Peyton Tolley starter pack. It's not as big. Maybe the extension isn't his outlier, but he does so many things well. And the other thing is, like, he's fiery. Like, he wants to win. You know, he's kind of got that lunatic mentality that I think, you know, can work as a starter. it's not all that different from like the way Chase Burns approaches it, you know? And he was better than Burns was at Tennessee. Like, I don't think he's necessarily like pound for pound the same prospect Burns is, but this is a really good college pitcher who had a ton of success in the SEC. And it's not like he's this undersized right-hander, you know, like a Carson Fulmer or a Jack Leiter, who, by the way, has kind of turned it around, of course. You know, with that, maybe the landing of pro ball won't be so easy. I mean, even his debut, like he barely pitched, like it was like two inning stints. Swing and miss stuff was there, you know. I think if there was relief risk, he wouldn't have gone as deep into starts as he did in college, frankly, and been the type of starter that he was. Like, that to me is the difference between drafting high school starting pitchers and college starting pitchers, is the college starting pitchers more often than not have proven that they're starting pitchers. Even when they become relievers, when they first get the call, like a Crochet, they find their way into the rotation. I just think it's in those guys' DNA, especially when they have to pitch in these big environments in the SEC. You can't replicate that type of environment in minor league baseball. You can't. You don't see it. I've been to Worcester, who's, you know, sells as many tickets for minor league games as you'll see. That is not like an SEC crowd on a Friday night. You know, it's not. It just isn't. And, you know, he spent 2 years in the SEC. You know, he continually leveled up every season, got better and better until, you know, he was one of the best, you know, starters in college baseball. So, yeah, I think, you know, he's somebody I consider at one. I think Cade Anderson is right there with him. He's a little bit safer than Doyle in some regards. But, you know, like, I don't know how big the upside is, frankly. Like, I don't know necessarily where like Anderson goes from here. I think he's more kind of ready-made. It's a little more refined. It's a good pitchability arsenal. Obviously the stuff is still pretty good. And we've seen him compete in big games. So I would consider those guys at one. I think if, you know, you are somebody who's competing this year and you were able to land the number one pick, however you're made the right trade last offseason, you know, with the guy who ended up with the number one pick. And you need a position player, like in my 30-team league, where, you know, prior to making that Chapman trade, if I was trying to trade up into like the top, you know, three picks so I could get Okamoto or Murakami. And I kind of figure like, well, at least it's a plug and play, you know, third baseman. So if like you need a corner infielder or first baseman, third baseman in a deeper league, I could see going number one with those guys as well. If none of the MPB guys are available and you are a team that is rebuilding and at the beginning of a rebuild and you want to take a shot, I could see taking a shot on Dax Kilby.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, you know, how crazy that might be, but I do have him as my top draft position player, Dylan. I'll bounce it back over to you. I am buying into the hype. I don't know what your thoughts are. That's why I wanted you to. Apparently, I can't talk. What your thoughts are on Kilby, but I can kind of go into my spiel after you say your spiel, because I know you've done some work on him.
Yeah, I mean, when the draftees start playing in the minors, and we got the Statcast data, we could see their production. I mean, he was obviously one that jumped out. The contact was very good, both regular contact and in-zone contact. He didn't chase at all, and he had a 104 90th percentile exit velocity. Yeah, it's a small sample size, but you know, he was hitting all the boxes that we like. We like the swing decisions, we like the contact, and then we like the quality of the contact. So he was like in the top 10, I think, in low A, even with his debut of only like 100 plate appearances. So I'm all in on Kilby. He plays shortstop right now. He's pretty athletic. So it's not just like a slugger who, you know, has good underlying stack ass. He's kind of like a baseball player. So I can definitely see Dax Kilby being in that conversation. And just about Liam Doyle, just going to be fascinating to see how it plays. Like I was tracking sort of the Division One college as like trying to do like a RoboScout version of it as the season was going. You know, Jamie Arnold started off so big and then he kind of tailed off, and Liam Doyle was just consistently at the top. And, you know, we have the Statcast, and it's, he's got one of the best fastballs. Maybe we'll talk about someone later in this episode who has a better fastball, but just super flat. And it'll just be fascinating how it pans out in the majors, just because he used it so like primarily, like it was like 80% fastballs. I just wonder how that will translate in the major leagues. Hopefully he's up this year. I have him in a bunch of DCs. Love the price. Get him in the 40th round or after. And you know, I really believe in the stuff. So I want to see how Liam Doyle does.
Yeah, I think there's some runway in that organization for him to find himself in that rotation fairly quickly. They haven't had a lot of guys like him. And I think there needs to be some credit that does go to Chaim Bloom for some of the groundwork that was kind of laid within the Red Sox organization that allowed all that development and pitching, et cetera, to flourish. You know, Breslow didn't draft all those guys. Some of the really good ones he did, but not all of them. And I think that Bloom has already done a good job of starting to really assemble some talented prospects there. So I agree with you. On Kilby, you know, I think it's just he has this combination of athleticism, potential power when you see in the underlying EVs, plate skills, and we have some track record to go off of already. Like, I think that matters. And I just think the tools in a class like this, where a lot of these prep shortstops kind of pick your poison. I think Eli Willits is in a real life setting is a really well-rounded, polished, interesting player with a lot of upside. And you may buy into that. I don't know that the power upside is there just based on his frame and athleticism and just the true meaning of projection. I just don't know if that like 20 home run type of projection is there, where I think that's there with Kilby with the speed and, you know, whether he's a shortstop, third baseman, center fielder, kind of has the legs and athleticism to move all over. So I kind of buy into that I think there's a really high end outcome here, maybe higher than some of the other guys. So in a draft where it's really muddled, I'm kind of going to go with a guy like that where I just believe in the tools.
And I think the Yankee factor is a real thing that, you know, they get so much hype, those prospects. And so I think having Dax Kilby, as opposed to Eli Willits in your example of the Nationals, like, I just think that he's going to be getting more hype than
Think that actually has. I don't know. I mean, unless you maybe play with a bunch of Yankees fans in leagues, like, I just feel like it has more negative connotation because there's a whole segment of the population, and that this doesn't happen with a Marlins prospect. It doesn't happen with a Brewers prospect. It doesn't happen with a Mariners prospect or a Rangers prospect or a D-backs prospect. But that Yankees prospect, he is always overrated. Even if he turns out to be, you know, whoever, right? Cam Schlittler. They're always overrated. And it almost has like the opposite effect on some guys where I feel like they're almost like underrated because they're Yankees or Red Sox prospects, you know? Where I don't know. I think there's a lot of overrated prospects for a lot of teams. That's just the nature of the business and the industry. Let's move on a little bit more. Let's talk a little bit about Seth Hernandez. I really buy into the Seth Hernandez upside. I think that if you want to say this could be the best player in the draft, absolutely. I also understand the studies that we've even done over the years on high school pitchers. It typically takes a minimum 6 years from when a guy gets drafted to when he's finally established in a rotation. And it's like by that point, the age factor is worn off, and that college starter in the same draft might have already been in the big leagues for 3 or 4 years, right? And like in a dynasty league, that matters because that 3 or 4 year starter, like once he's in year two, you can probably sell that guy for a mint. Well, this guy might be coming off of Tommy John surgery. Now, I don't wish that on Seth Hernandez. He's been very healthy, but he throws 100 miles an hour. He's got a few different pitches. He's got feel. He's an athletic mover. There's good extension, all that sort of stuff. Like, people are going to love Seth Hernandez. So you know, I do think it's going to be like your Andrew Painters and, you know, those types. But I think we've seen some bumps along the way for those types. There haven't been, I mean, other than even Hunter Green had his bumps along the way. Mm-hmm. Those players are tough to roster for a long period of time, you know, because they're not the easiest trade chips. Dax Kilby or Eli Willits are probably going to be JoJo Parker, who we also have in that range, right? Mm-hmm. Those are going to be easier trade chips than a Seth Hernandez is going to be doing, right? And that's one of the reasons that, you know, I went with the players I did, and I went Kilby, Parker, Willits, and then I put Hernandez there. He's before the international guys who signed today, because it is January 15th as we're recording this. Luis Hernandez from the Giants and Johansi Colom with the Athletics, both shortstops, very talented, followed by Steel Hall, Gavin Fien, and then we get into some of the college guys. I think that states, like, I will draft Hernandez in the right scenario, you know. But I think when you're comparing him to some of who I consider to be the three top prep shortstops in this class, I get a little bit more cautious. So I'm going to pump the brakes a little bit there, because it is still, like I said, a prep pitcher, no matter how talented Hernandez is. And we just don't have as much information on some of these guys as we do on, you know, even some of the prep position prospects.
Yeah, I mean, I see the argument, like, you know, in the FYPD mock draft we just did, you read on the site, Carlos had the sixth pick and he took him, and he said in his blurb, you know, he probably would have taken him number one. He's got the highest upside, that type of thing. I totally get that argument, but I am on your side about the, like, the time horizon thing. Like, I don't want to wait. The worst is when you wait, the guy finally debuts and then is not great. Like, he needs a year, and then, but that year he was terrible. Like, I don't know, Lucas Giolito or something. And then it's like, oh, do I still roster him? Do I take out one of my valuable roster spots for this guy because he's no longer minors eligible, like in the leagues I play in? And I just hate having to make that decision. Another thing that happens is that, like, you know, a starter, if he becomes a reliever, he basically is a zero. But if Eli Willits moves from shortstop to second, he's still a prospect who's going to be valuable in fantasy. So, like, I think the pitchers, obviously, it's well-worn and well-documented how they're, you know, they're the risky ones and don't invest in young pitchers and no such thing as a pitching prospect, all that stuff. I mean, there's so many different angles of why that's true that I don't think I could take Seth Hernandez that early unless I'm definitely rebounding. I'm just trying to hit, like, on a rebuilding, and I just want to hit a home run. And, you know, I need the home run, I need the lottery ticket, then maybe I would do it. But if I'm just trying to build a team,
sure,
and I'm probably not going to take him.
Yeah, I could see it, like, you know, after the top guys go in, like, a points league, you know, and if maybe if you have deeper minor spots and that sort of thing, you can hold them. Mm-hmm. That guy could certainly be really valuable for you if it potentially pays off. But let's go into what I really like in this class, Dylan, and that is the loaded prep shortstop class. Because even after, so, you know, in terms of how we have them lined up, Kilby, Parker, Willits, Steel Hall, Gavin Fien, Ethan Holiday at 16, Josh Hammond at 18, Xavier Nyans at 19. So I'm kind of off of Holiday. I just think that, like, the whiffs were so bad. We know there's impact there. I don't think he's going to stick at shortstop. I think he's really going to move down the defensive spectrum. He's really going to have to hit. I have major questions on that hit tool, and I just don't know. Yeah, even if it gets a lot better, it's still going to be pretty bad, like, right? You know, like, I can't just completely hand wave away how bad the pro debut was when we're hearing for 2 years from a lot of more honest people within the space that had spent a lot of time on Holiday, at least, like, that worked with teams, were like, I don't know if this guy's hit tool is as good as people think. And it looks like it's clearly, you know, maybe a 40 projection hit tool if you're rosy, I don't know how you could put a 50 on this or he gets there. It's just, he's a different type of hitter from his brother. He's a power guy. I'm not adverse to like rostering him. I just think like, and this seems to be the consensus more and more, I just think that the value on him at this moment has changed versus some of these other guys, in my opinion. And I even think like, if you prefer Josh Hammond or Xavier Nyans, Nyans has similar hit tool concerns, but it's more power than Holiday has. Maybe better angles too. That's exciting, especially if you think the hit tool can come along. He's got a lot of Roman Anthony comps from scouts. Hammond is a two-way guy. It's going to be spending his time as a position player going forward. But it's kind of like 50s and 55s all across the board. Maybe there's 60 power in there if things really max out. So it's a really talented group. And then I think you can kind of go a little bit deeper into like a Billy Carlson, who I have at 26. A lot of people are completely off Billy Carlson. I think that's foolish. I think that I think there's still a chance he could hit. This could be like a Mason Wynn type of player where he's a standout defender. He runs. There's enough power with, you know, a polished bat to ball ability and hit tool better than people even anticipated. And I think that's kind of what Wynn was. This guy was a high level player all over the place. And he's a really good athlete, and there's potentially more power projection there than people realize, you know. Definitely can't write those guys off. Also a big fan of Quentin Young, who I have at 31. You know, part of the famous Young family with Delman and Dimitri. He's a really impressive athlete, probably ends up at third base, huge power, almost James Wood-ish type of a profile. And then Aiden West, who I think might be one of the best combinations of power and speed in the high school class. He's the guy that I've really gone to the table on at 33. I don't think you're going to see Aiden West that high too many places, but I'm a big Aiden West believer. So that kind of goes through some of the prep shortstops there.
Let me throw you on the hot seat for a sec. Connor Griffin, who among this prep group could possibly have sort of the Connor Griffin trajectory? Not doesn't have to be the same type of player, like doesn't have to be a power speed guy, but someone who could maybe be in the conversation for top prospect next year.
Yeah, I don't know if there is a guy like that. I mean, like, I guess it'd probably be like a Dax Kilby. Billy Carlson's knocks are eerily similar to Connor Griffin's, but I don't think anybody is I don't think anybody is expecting, you know, that kind of, he doesn't have a Connor Griffin body, so I don't think anyone's anticipating that's going to happen.
Be the first. Say it right now. Billy Carlson's the next Connor Griffin.
I'm not going to say Billy Carlson's the next Connor Griffin. I have every White Sox podcast on earth sampling that, posting it on the internet. So I don't know. We can jump through a few more of these guys here. We're going a little long, so.
Let's jump to Gage Wood. I teased it a bit about Liam Doyle maybe having the best fastball, but you know, Gage Wood's stuff and what we saw in the underlying is pretty fantastic. Go, I know you like Gage Wood, so talk about.
Yeah, I mean, we did see a little bit of Gage Wood after the draft, but I think we'll see him more obviously at a full season level this year, which will be exciting. And I think the reason for that is it's really, really good stuff. Fastball last year at Arkansas sat 96 miles an hour up to 98. You know, pretty decent extension for an undersized guy. He's listed at 6 feet. He's probably more like 5'11". He's getting like 6'4 extension. It's like a 4.0, 4.1 VAA. So it's really flat. Even if that ticks up a little bit in pro ball, it's still going to be, you know, a 96 mile per hour fastball that's pretty flat from a low release height with more induced vertical break than you would expect from that release height. He's got a nasty curveball as well. It's like low to mid 80s, so like 83 to 85, super high spin, you know, 2600, 2700 RPMs, big two plane movement, got a ton of swings and misses on that one, really plays off of that that four seam fastball. The question is, you know, can he develop a third pitch? He kind of showed a cutter type slider gyro pitch a little bit at Arkansas. I didn't throw it a ton. The Phillies I've heard have him working on that and could have him throwing it a little bit more. And then, you know, we'll see about the off speed. So there's definitely some relief risk here. But I also think that he could have, and maybe it's just in the name Gage, could have like a Gage jump type of rise next season where he really performs, college starter, big fastball, and he just kind of eats with those two pitches and slowly develops the third pitch, the third look.
Yeah, I mean, he threw like 400 fastballs compared to Liam Doyle's like 1,000, but higher velocity, it was flatter, more whiff, better CSW, more extension as well. So like that effective velocity is even more. So really love the fastball as much as Liam Doyle's fastball eats. So does Gage Wood. So I really like that. I think he is kind of underrated, but I think people are kind of catching up on that. You have him pretty high, and I think James Anderson has him pretty high too. So he's not really under the radar anymore.
Yeah, I think there's even chance that like I'm lower on him by a couple spots than some other people. But I think that's an appropriate spot. You want to go a little higher. Now, I think these draft rankings, especially when it's specific to something like this, you got to think about your league. You got to think about your team and use it as a roadmap, right? Kind of look at, all right, I don't want this kind of a player. I'm going to go for this kind of a player. I want a prep player. I want a, you know, college starter. Maybe you push Gage Wood up 10 spots, right? But just kind of lay of the land. This is how I laid it all out, Dylan. I appreciate you helping me out with this one today, Dylan. For all those that have tuned in, thank you for tuning in to another Baseball America Fantasy Podcast.
Cheers.